Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Hurry! These July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Anything to lose. I have no secrets to hide. I could just be blunt and people could judge it however they judge it.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. We're now 12 weeks into our investigation of the murder of DeMario Lowe's. It seems like at this point that we have a pretty good idea of how the murder happened. But I'm going to tell you right now that this episode, the one you're about to listen to, might be the most important episode of this entire season. In this episode, we're going to get our best look into what actually happened to DeMario Lowe's. This is what we think we know up to this point. Mario was driving around that night with his friend Canvas Smith. She says that Andre Williams was also with them. Now, Andre says that he saw Mario alone on the street a couple blocks away. They had some drinks and they parted companies in opposite directions. James Blackwell says that Mario was at his house for a bit. The exact movements leading up to the murder are still a little bit murky, particularly concerning Andre. Everyone has a different story. Canvas says that they dropped Andre off at the crime scene right before Mario dropped her off at home. But Andre says he was never even in the car with Mario and Canvas that night, and he was never anywhere near the crime scene. The best guess I can come up with about Mario's movements in the minutes leading up to his murder was that he dropped Canvas off at her house a few blocks away, told her that he had something to do and he would be back to get her later, and then he went to 784 Broadway. I say that's my best guess because that's the only part of the story that no one refutes. So like I said, things are murky in that final hour, but after that, we seem to have a pretty clear picture. Mario pulls up to the empty lot next to 784 Broadway in his little red hatchback, and he stands outside of his car for a bit listening to music. At some point, he opens his trunk and he props it open, and we're told that he was looking inside. Then, a car pulls into the alley behind the house. A man walks up to Mario at his car, they talk for a few minutes, and then the talking turns to arguing, and moments later, gunshots ring out. At first, the shooting is happening outside by the car, but then it moves into the house. More shots, 8 or 9 in total, including the shots outside and the ones that happened inside. It appears that Mario tried to run up the stairs to Victoria Miles' apartment, but he never made it. He collapses down the stairs, having been shot 4 times. The killer then ran back to the alley to their car, got in, and sped off down the alley to the north. That is the only narrative that was presented at trial, and for the most part, that narrative went unchallenged. The focus at trial by the defense was to determine who the person was that was seen running back to the alley. The state obviously contended that it was Jody, and the defense made the argument that it, well, wasn't Jody. There was never really a question as to if that's how the murder actually occurred. The only question was who did it. But today I want us to back up for a minute. I want us to really take a look at why everyone believes that that's what happened. The answer is Victoria Miles. That's her story, and only her story. A story that changed a lot between the night of the murder and trial. As it turns out, Victoria's version of the story wasn't the only one that was given to McGinnis. It was just the one that made it to trial. There were actually several other witnesses to Mario's murder. But before we get to the other witness accounts that didn't make the prosecutor's cut, let's first talk about some of the obvious problems with Victoria's version. First, and most obvious, is Victoria's claim that she saw the killer running away back to the car in the alley. She gave a very clear description of this person to the jury at trial. Tall and thin and with a ponytail. That description was a dead ringer for the person that was sitting at the defense table, Jody Hill, who at trial had their hair in a ponytail. But my issue with the description isn't necessarily about the details. It's about how it was humanly possible for her to have seen the person fleeing at all. It's indisputable that there was zero exterior lighting on the north side of the house, which is where Victoria claims to have seen the person running. So it was pitch black outside, with no lights within 100 feet of the house. Victoria claims that the killer was silhouetted by a motion light on the side of a house to the north of the crime scene. The problem is that there was an entire empty lot between the two buildings. Actually, two empty lots. Also, the existence of that light was never verified. Not a picture, it's not in a diagram, nothing. We just have Victoria claiming that it was there. That house is still standing today, and there is zero evidence that there was ever a light of any kind on the side of it. No wires, no electrical box, no conduit, nothing. So the idea of the light even being there at all is questionable at best. But then you have to consider the physics of the situation. Victoria's apartment was upstairs. The sill of the window that she says she was looking out of was approximately 12 to 14 feet off the ground. If she was standing up, her eyes would have been about 17 feet above the ground. Stay with me, we're about to do some geometry. First, we have to consider how far away from her building would a person have to be for her to be able to see them at all. She couldn't look straight down. She wasn't hanging her head out the window. There's a blind spot there. If you have a two-story house, go do a little experiment. Stand in an upstairs room and see how close to the building you can see out of the window. The way my windows are set, I have about a 5-foot blind spot next to the house where I can't see anything at all. So that would mean that even though the car is supposedly parked directly behind the house, the killer had to be running at least 5 or 6 feet to the north of the house to be seen at all. Which isn't crazy, but then you have to factor in the light. Now, like I said, I don't think there was a light at all. In fact, I'm pretty damn sure of it. But for the sake of argument, let's say there was a light on the house to the north. That light would be approximately 100 feet or more away and mounted around 8 foot off the ground. Think about where the fleeing killer would have had to have been standing in order for Victoria, from her second floor window, to see them silhouetted by that light. I think the technical answer is pretty damn far away. Like really far away. I think they would have had to have been within 20 feet of that other house for Victoria to have seen what she says she saw. So imagine that. The killer runs out the front door. Their car is parked directly behind the house. It's pitch black outside. But instead of running straight back to the car, the offender runs in this huge 100-foot arc towards the light and then back to the house. That's what would have had to have happened in order for Victoria's story at trial to even be possible. Doesn't seem likely, does it? But that's not all. Tonight, after it gets dark, when you're sitting inside your house with the lights on, look out your window and take note of what you see. I can tell you what you're going to see. Yourself. You're going to see your own reflection in the window. Generally speaking, you can't see out of your windows at night when you have a light on or even just a TV on inside. Now, in this story, there is a light on the house to the north. That would make it a little easier. But unless something is directly between you and the light, you're still not going to see it. And remember, Victoria's eyes were 17 feet off the ground, and the imaginary light is 8 feet off the ground. So unless the killer was levitating 10 feet above the grass, they were not between the light and Victoria's eyes. And let's just say, as long as we're being ridiculous, that somehow Victoria could see this person. They ran in that huge arc into the light, and maybe she cupped her hands on the window to see, seconds after the shooting stopped. The silhouette that she would have been looking at would have been 100 feet away or more, and running. So they would have only been in the light for, what, 2 seconds? How much detail do you think she could make out at that distance under those conditions? I'm almost done here, but I want to quickly make sure that we're touching on all of the reasons why maybe Victoria's account of the murder might not be the best source. We've talked about this before, but the timing of when she looked outside is worth noting again. According to her trial testimony, during the shooting, Victoria is protecting her niece. She says that she pushed her into the kitchen. So try to put yourself in that state of mind. And remember, she said she heard shots outside, and then claimed she thought that was just Mario messing around with a gun, but then the commotion and shooting moved inside. She could hear the shooting right outside her door from the stairway. Now pay close attention, because the sequence of events will be important as we get into some other testimony here shortly. So Victoria says that the shooting, inside the building, stops. Then, in order to have seen the offender fleeing the scene, she would have had to immediately get up and run and look out the north-facing windows. In the seconds after the shooting stopped, which was happening inside the building. That has never made sense to me. Why would she immediately look to the north when the front of the apartment where the shooting was happening faces east? And of course, we have the menagerie of stories about when she looked out that window. First, she says she ran to the back of the house to get the phone to call 911, and then she looked outside, which of course makes no sense because the killer would already be gone at that point. Then she says she got the phone and called 911 and was looking outside while she was on the phone, which again, still doesn't make sense. If the killer immediately ran to the car after the shooting, they would be past the window in a matter of 3 to 5 seconds. By the time Victoria even dialed 911, they would have already been gone. And let's not forget that the 911 call didn't actually come in until after Takamoto had already heard the shots, turned around, and searched a 2-block area, and another call had come in reporting the shooting in the general direction. Nothing regarding the timing adds up at all. Something else I think that we should take note of before we move on is Victoria's description of the taillights in the getaway car. In her first interview, there's no mention of the taillights at all. All she says is that it was a small, boxy car that she didn't get a good look at because of the plastic on the windows. But by the time trial rolls around, Victoria says that she noticed the car turning onto Clay from Broadway. She then got up, walked into the kitchen, and observed the car stopping on Clay for long enough for her to observe and remember the taillights. And you're going to see in a few minutes why that stop had to be added at trial. The prosecutor needed Victoria to have seen the taillights on Clay rather than in the alley as it sped away. And then, of course, we have the plastic on the windows. This element of Victoria's statement is obviously outrageous. She notes on the night of the murder that the reason she didn't get a good look at the offender or the car was because of the plastic on her windows. At trial, she says there was no plastic on any windows. There is zero chance that's true. She offered that information on the night of the murder while she was in her house with the police. That's not a detail you just make up. She wasn't asked if there was plastic on the windows. McGinnis and McKinney could see the plastic. They were in her house, and she mentioned it as an explanation as to why she didn't get a good look. And that ties in with what Jody said during their testimony. During Jody's testimony, they said that if the jury would look at the picture that Cotter had put up as evidence of Victoria's apartment after the fire, you could actually see the plastic, what was left of it after the fire, still on the windows. And that happened in May. The bottom line is that there's just no chance that Victoria's story is true. Nothing about identifying the offender or the car adds up. And what we need to be asking ourselves is, if she was lying about those parts, why do we believe the rest of the story? Why have we, and everyone else up to this point, allowed Victoria's version of events to become the narrative?
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9, selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9, selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Last week, when I read some of Jody's trial testimony to you, I went over the part where Jody talks about what Victoria said in the recording of her 911 call. When I recorded that episode, I had an email out to Jody asking them to explain what they meant by that. Since then, Jody has written me back. Now, Jody has the advantage of having actually heard the tape. And they said that in the recording, Victoria tells the dispatcher that there, quote, are a bunch of people down there. And that leads us to the only other eyewitness to the murder who actually testified, Dewan James. I mentioned Dewan 2 weeks ago when we were discussing the gunshot residue collected from the University of Michigan jacket and Jody's car. But there's a lot more to Dewan's story. Dewan got dragged into this investigation, reluctantly, by, you guessed it, the Miles family. From McGinnis's report, quote, on Monday, May 2002, I received a phone message from Glenda Miles. Upon later speaking to her, this same date, she advised me that she knew of a male subject who witnessed the shooting of Demario Lowe's. She stated that the person was a friend of her daughter, Dora Miles. I later spoke to Dora Miles, who advised me that the subject's name was Dewan James. End quote. So Glenda calls McGinnis and tells him about this witness that her daughter, Dora, had told her about. McGinnis then talks to Dora, who sends him to Dewan James. Someone asked me in the follow-up 2 weeks ago if I thought James was a credible witness. And the answer is that I really don't know. I don't see any obvious motivation for him to lie, and he certainly wasn't overly eager to talk to the police. In fact, McGinnis's report says, quote, James reluctantly gave a statement about what he had seen on the night of 11-16-01 in the 700 block of Broadway at approximately 12:30 a.m., end quote. Note here that McGinnis makes sure to point out that the murder happened at 12:30 a.m. When you hear James's trial testimony, you'll see that it's pretty apparent that that time did not come from Dewan. But like I said, I don't see any reason for Dewan to be making up this story. It's a little suspect that the police were directed to him by the Miles family, but just based on Victoria's ever-changing story and Carvale being a suspect, I have to really question anything that comes from them. But he doesn't actually say anything particularly helpful for the case against Jody. He also doesn't say anything that points the finger towards or away from Carvale. My only real concern is that his story does change slightly from what McGinnis wrote in his report about the interview to what Dewan actually says on the stand. But that's kind of par for the course in this case. It really seems like McGinnis's MO here was to interview a witness, write down what he wanted them to say, rather than what they actually said, and then apply pressure to get them to play ball later down the road. Some do, and end up testifying, and some don't, and disappear from the narrative. A good example with Dewan was the statement about the jacket. In the report, it says James described the jacket as, quote, possibly black and gray with designs on the shoulders and sleeves, end quote. While the jacket from Jody's car wasn't black and gray, McGinnis tried to set it up to look that way. He took black and white photos in a dimly lit room that he wanted to show to James. In that setting, Dewan's description could loosely fit the Michigan jacket. The reason being that the shoulders and sleeves of the actual jacket from Jody's car were white and maize. But at trial, we get to hear Dewan's actual description of the jacket. Black, with a gray stripe. No designs on the shoulders or sleeves, and no use of the word possibly. In fact, he was very clear and even doubled down. Quote, I just remember the black jacket and it had a gray stripe in the back of it. It was black. End quote. So there is a change in the description, but it appears that the change was the result of maybe McGinnis bending the truth in his report, then Dewan actually speaking for himself. The same appears to be true when it comes to the time of the murder. In his report, McGinnis says that he asked Dewan what he remembered from the night of the 16th at 12:30 a.m. But at trial, we get a much better estimate as to when the murder actually occurred. Listen to how Dewan describes his night from the transcript. Quote, what time, strike that, where do you work? Well, at the time, I was working at J.L. French. Okay, and what were your hours? 3 o'clock to 11 o'clock. On that night, did you work to 11 o'clock? Yes. All right, when you got off work, where did you go? I went on Broadway. It was like, I don't know the exact address, but it was like right across the street and two houses down from the corner. Why were you at that residence? I was looking for my cousin. End quote. So Dewan got off work at J.L. French, an automotive factory, at 11 p.m. and then went straight to Broadway. At the time, the J.L. French factory was located about 2.5 miles away from the crime scene, maybe a 5-minute drive. So give a few minutes to get out of his car, and it's safe to say that Dewan was at Broadway, across the street and up a couple lots from the crime scene, no later than 11:15 p.m. Now, if McGinnis's claim that the murder happened at 12:40 a.m. is true, it would mean that Dewan was hanging around outside on the street for nearly an hour and a half, not hanging out with his cousin. He never actually found his cousin that night. Now let's look at the details of Dewan's night. First from the report on his interview, then we'll hear it in his own words from trial. Here's the story from the interview report. Quote, I spoke to James on 5/22/02 at 1:28 p.m. James stated that he was parked in a vacant lot across the street from 784 Broadway on the night of the shooting. He stated that he was there with some other unknown individuals. James stated that he saw the victim, Demario Lowe's, drive up and park his car next to the building at 784 Broadway. James stated that the victim was listening to music. James said that he did not actually know Demario Lowe's but had seen him around before. James stated at one point he saw Lowe's go into the trunk of his car. James said that he did not see the perpetrator approach Lowe's, but he heard a loud gunshot. James stated that the sound of the gun was extremely loud, like it was a large caliber weapon. James stated that he ducked down to the ground after hearing the first shot. James stated that he then heard several other gunshots in succession, at least 6 shots. James said that he looked across the street and saw the shooter standing in the doorway of the building. James said the suspect was standing in the doorway firing the weapon at Lowe's. James stated that he was unable to get a description of the perpetrator. James stated that he was, quote, was shooting like he was throwing the bullets. James then demonstrated to me how the shooter was firing the gun, covering his face with his left arm and shooting the gun with his right hand in a pushing motion. James stated that he did not see the shooter's face and could not describe him. However, he saw the shooter's coat, which he described as possibly being black and gray with designs on the shoulders and sleeves. James stated that he was not exactly sure of the color, but he would recognize the coat if he saw it again. James stated shortly after the shooting, he saw a car in the back alley speed away with the lights off. James stated that he saw an arm hanging out of the doorway to the building, assumed it was the victim's, but he stated he did not go over to assist because he did not want anyone to think he was involved in the shooting. He stated he later saw police arrive on scene. I asked James why he had not come forward with this information. He stated that he was fearful and did not want to get involved. His mother, unknown, also urged him not to get involved. She was very intrusive in our conversation, stating that we could not protect James if he became a witness. End quote. So these are the bullet points of Dewan's story, according to McGinnis. First, Dewan says that he was across the street from the vacant lot with, quote, some other unknown individuals. Right away, I'm seeing some concern about McGinnis's report. One is consistent throughout the case. Notice how McGinnis never asked him what time he was there, where he worked, what time he got off, nothing that would narrow down what time the murder occurred. And before you even ask, let me answer. No, that's not normal. Not in any case. Even if there isn't an issue with the timing, meaning even if we knew for a fact what time the murder occurred, detectives will still pin down a time from a witness like this, if for no other reason to verify their statement is legitimate. My other issue is that McGinnis just writes that there are other people there with Dewan, but he says that they're unknown. Go through the file and read all of McGinnis's other reports, and you'll see things like, "It should be noted that I asked who the other witnesses were, and James was reluctant to reveal their names." Or, "My super detective spidey senses were telling me that James wouldn't reveal the names for fear of retaliation." Something like that. We always hear some excuse as to why details like this are missing. But in this case, the other people on the scene were just unknown. I have a theory. Personally, I don't think Dewan said anything about anyone else being there with him. I think McGinnis just made that up. And I say that for two reasons. One, as you'll hear shortly, at trial, Dewan testifies that he was alone when the shots went off. So there's that. And two, because of what I just mentioned. There's no indication that McGinnis made any attempt to figure out who these other witnesses were. And I just don't buy that. So that leads us to the why. If this is a lie on McGinnis's part, what would be his motivation to make up a group of people that don't exist? I think it's time. Time would be his motivation. Even though he didn't document it, my guess is that McGinnis learned in that interview that Dewan got off work at 11 p.m., 2 miles away. And why would Dewan hang around the area by himself for an hour and a half? He probably wouldn't. So in McGinnis's report, we lose the detail that Dewan was only there because he was looking to pick up his cousin, and instead we add in a group of mystery people. Then the picture becomes that Dewan was just hanging out with some guys from the neighborhood, which is not at all what he says he was doing in his trial testimony. Continuing on with the beats of his story from the report, James says that he sees DeMario pull up in his car and listen to music, and he sees him open his trunk at some point. It sounds like Dewan really isn't paying that much attention to Mario. He never sees the shooter arrive, he's just alerted to a problem when he hears gunshots. McGinnis's report says that when Dewan heard the shot, he, quote, ducked down to the ground. No word on what the other imaginary people are doing at this point. James just ducks to the ground when he hears the first shot, then he hears several more shots, then he looks up to see someone standing in the doorway of the house, shooting into the house. So Dewan wasn't looking at Mario when his attacker or attackers approached him, and when he heard the first shot, which occurred outside, he was ducked down, which seems very reasonable to me. Then he saw the shooter unloading from the doorway into the building. And then lastly, he says that he saw a car speed away in the back alley with the lights off. Remember what I said earlier. There was a reason why the car stopping on Clay Street and her odd interest in the car had to come into Victoria's story, because she couldn't have seen the taillights in the alley as the car sped away, because according to the only other witness to testify at trial, the car had its lights off. In general, I think Dewan's story seems very reasonable. There are discrepancies, sure, but I don't think those discrepancies came from Dewan. My guess is that those details came from McGinnis, like Sonia Lucas's dying declaration story. But when we look at the nuts and bolts of his story, it makes sense. Dewan is on the street looking for his cousin. He notices Mario pull up and look in his trunk, but doesn't pay much attention to him. Then he hears a shot, which scares the shit out of him, so he hits the deck. Then he sees the shooter in the doorway and he sees the car drive off. There are gaps there, but those gaps make sense. Remember, it's pitch dark outside and there was no exterior lights on the house. Street lights might light up the area where DeMario was parked, but over by the house, the only place where you could really see anyone was in the doorway under the porch light. It also makes sense that you would only look that direction if someone opened the door. because that would shine a bright light into an otherwise dark area. And again, since there were no lights on the side of the house either, you wouldn't be able to see the person run to the car. Because of the porch light, you might have seen them run towards the side of the house, but once they turned the corner, you wouldn't be able to see them anymore. The next thing you would hear would be the car. But notice that McGinnis doesn't mention anything about Dewan hearing the car. Now keep in mind that this interview was conducted just 20 days after the simulation was done with Victoria. So it's not like McGinnis hadn't thought to ask anyone what the car sounded like. But for what it's worth, the report says that Dewan, quote, saw a car in the back alley speed away with the lights off. Remember that when we get into Dewan's trial testimony right after this break.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9, selection varies by location while supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Okay, so we have a general version of events that Dewan James witnessed from McGinnis' report. He's hanging out on Broadway with a group of unknown people. He sees Mario pull up to 784 Broadway in his car. Mario's listening to music. Dewan sees him open the trunk. Dewan hears a gunshot and he hits the deck. He hears more gunshots, and when he looks up, he sees a man standing in the doorway of the house shooting into the house. Then he sees a car speed away down the alley. He then notices that there's an arm hanging out the front door of the house, and then the police arrive. That's the story according to McGinnis. Now, we're going to go over the story according to Dewan, in his own words, at trial. First things first, like I mentioned in the last segment, we learn about what time James got to Broadway. He was working at J.L. French, which is about 2 miles away, and he headed straight to Broadway. Now, in McGinnis' version, we don't have any idea what time he got there. We hear nothing about work, nor do we hear why Dewan was there. He's just hanging out with some unknown people that I think are just a figment of McGinnis' imagination. But here at trial, we get the details. Off work at 11 p.m. and go straight to Broadway. And we learn the purpose of the trip. Dewan was looking for his cousin, Willie, and there were no mystery people. Dewan was by himself when the shots were fired. From the transcript, quote, "You said you were looking for your cousin. Did you find him?" "No, he..." "What was your cousin's name?" "His name is Willie." "Why were you in that particular area looking for him?" "Because I was coming to pick him up. We was going to go riding, and I think it was a bar night, and we was going to go to the bar." End quote. So in reality, James wasn't hanging out with some guys on the street, which might explain why he was there for an hour and a half. He was by himself, just there to pick up his cousin to go to the bar. He did, however, have contact with some people, but just to ask them if they had seen Willie. But they weren't around when the shooting started. From the transcript, quote, "Did you talk to anybody there on the street?" "No." "Well, I asked a couple of guys had they seen him, and they told me no." "Okay, and did something happen while you were standing there?" "Yes, some shots, gunshots." "Was anybody near you when you heard the shots?" "No." "Where were you standing at the time?" "I was sitting in my car." "Sitting in your car and you heard shots? What did you do when you heard the shots?" "I ducked down." End quote. Something that should have grabbed your attention there. Not only was Dewan alone at the time of the murder, he wasn't even outside. He was in his car. Let me read you again what McGinnis wrote in his report. Quote, "He stated that he was there with some other unknown individuals. James said that he did not see the perpetrator approach Lowe's, but he heard a loud gunshot. James stated that the sound of the gun was extremely loud, like it was a large caliber weapon. James said that he ducked down to the ground after hearing the first shot." End quote. I don't want to get too caught up here in details and conflicts, because the goal today is to get a better idea of what actually happened that night. So let's for now chalk this up to a miscommunication. McGinnis did start the report saying that James was parked across the street, and maybe he was there with some other unknown individuals, was referring to the people that Duan asked if they had seen Willie. And maybe by ducking down to the ground, he meant duck down in his car. Let's just say that McGinnis is bad at writing reports, and let's focus on what Duan is actually saying happened. So Duan gets off work at 11 and heads over to Broadway to pick up his cousin Willie to go to the bar. We can assume that he arrived at 11:10, maybe 11:15 or so. He parks his car and asks a couple of people if they've seen Willie, and they say no. Those people are not anywhere around when Duan is sitting in his car when he hears the shots. My first question that we don't have an answer to is, what happened to the couple guys that Duan talked to shortly before the murder? We have a couple of unknown men hanging around across the street from the crime scene just before Mario was shot. Are they potential witnesses? Potential suspects? Sadly, neither McGinnis or Cotter seemed to care. They already had their sights set on Jody. But getting back to the testimony, if you've never taken the time to read any of the trial transcripts that I have posted on the website, I'd ask that you take the time to read this one. Getting back to the question about Duan James's credibility, when you read his testimony word for word, I think you'll come to the same conclusion that I did. I believe every word this man is saying, every word of it. This is what a truthful witness sounds like. Throughout the testimony, he shares the facts that he knows. He tells the jury that he doesn't know if he doesn't know something, but when he's sure of a part of a story, he doubles down on it and makes clear why he's so sure. And he corrects the attorneys when they get something wrong. In my opinion, he is doing his absolute best to share exactly what he knows. And this is what we learn. Duan was sitting in his car in an empty lot, which is across the street from the empty lot where Damari was parked, but just a little bit further to the north. He was backed into the space, so when he was looking out of his windshield, he was looking probably about 100 feet, 80 feet away from where Mario was at. Mario was further to his left. He saw Mario over there, and he saw him open his trunk. James has asked several times if he heard music coming from Mario's car, and he repeatedly makes clear that he never heard any music. Which is interesting, because in McGinnis's report, he says that Duan said that Mario was over there listening to music. But when we hear from Duan, he never heard any. And that's important, because what the state and McGinnis want you to believe is that the reason Mario's trunk was open was because he was out there listening to music, and he had his trunk open to expose the speaker so it would be louder. But it wasn't loud. Duan couldn't even hear the music from across the street. Which, if you ask me, points back to my theory that Mario was there to meet someone. Whatever they were meeting about was in the trunk. We know that Mario dealt marijuana, so it's not a huge leap to think that he had money or marijuana in that trunk. Which would be extremely important considering that there was nothing of value found in the trunk by the police. So what was Mario looking at in there just before he was murdered? Duan sees Mario over there, he sees him open his trunk, but he's not paying any attention to him or what he's doing. Duan's just sitting in his own car, hanging out, waiting for his cousin. And shockingly, no one bothered to ask him how long he was waiting. But it sounds like the car was backed into the lot and was facing the street. Like I said, the crime scene was across the street, in front of him, and about two lots down to the left. So he's not looking at Mario when he heard the first shot. He testifies that he didn't know what direction the shot was coming from. He just heard a loud shot and he ducked down, like leaned over to the passenger seat. As more shots rang out, up to about six of them, he continued to hide leaned over the passenger seat. When the shooting seemed to slow down, he then peeked up over his dashboard, and that's when he saw the man standing in the front door shooting inside. So what we have here is a gap in the timeline as far as what Duan saw that night. He saw Mario looking in his trunk, and the next time he looked in that direction, it was already several seconds into the attack. Mario was clearly already inside the building, and the killer was firing the fatal shots. So just keep that in mind. Duan wasn't looking that direction or paying attention when the killer or killers approached Mario. He wasn't looking when the first several shots were fired. He wasn't looking when Mario and his killer ran into the house. There's nothing at all nefarious about that. Duan is just being honest. He wasn't paying attention, and the first shot scared the shit out of him, and so he ducked out of sight, which is exactly what I think just about anyone would do in that situation. But there is one other detail that Duan adds that no one bothers to dig into. Before the attack began, someone walked into the house. Quote, "Did you ever see a car parking over by 784 Broadway? I saw the guy who got shot. His car was across or was right next door in the lot. All right, did you see that guy before you heard the shots that made you duck down? I saw a person go in. I don't know if it was him, the guy who got shot, or somebody was going into the apartment because it was an apartment building, but I never did pay that no attention. Do you know if that guy was playing his music in his car stereo? Did you hear that? I didn't hear it. Okay. I didn't hear no car stereo." End quote. So Duan says that he saw a person go into the house. He doesn't know if it was, quote, the guy who got shot, but he saw someone walk into that house before the murder. That is really, really important. Victoria said Mario never came inside. She said she heard him pull up and looked out the window and saw him by his car. Sonia was inside with her stepfather and kids and didn't even know Mario was out there. She was in bed when the shooting started. But Victoria's story is the one that has my hackles up. She gave a detailed description of Mario pulling up, seeing the car, and hearing him argue with someone that she says she assumed was Andre Williams. But no one ever came inside. But I can't help but notice that she just assumed he was out there arguing with Dre. Then we have Canvas Smith, who says that she and Mario dropped Andre off at that house just before Mario dropped her off and returned to the house. And now we have Duan saying that sometime after he got there at 11:15-ish and before the shooting started, he saw someone walk into the house. And yet according to Victoria, no one ever did. The idea that someone else was there that night and Duan saw that person has my head spinning. But for now, let's finish getting through his trial testimony. So after the shooting stopped, Duan saw the killer run away. And he explains in detail how and where the killer ran. This is one of the elements of his testimony that becomes crystal clear after both the prosecution and defense questioned James about it several times. Duan says, without question, that the killer ran to the back of the house between Mario's car and the building. And remember, Mario's car was parked right next to the building. He did not say that the killer ran in some giant, ridiculous loop like Victoria described in an attempt to explain her bizarre silhouette identification. James says that after the shooting stopped, the killer immediately ran down the front steps and around the front of the building to the north, and then ran west alongside the building between it and Mario's car. He describes the path as a U, down the steps, around the front, and straight back. He couldn't get a good look at the killer's face, even though they were running directly towards him at one point, because it was too dark. In other words, Victoria's testimony about seeing the killer silhouetted by the non-existent light on the house to the north is not only impossible, but also directly contradicted by Duan James' testimony. The timing. Seconds after the shooting, the killer ran back to the alley. Not enough time for Victoria to have got her phone before looking out the window and seeing the killer. And the route. She could not have seen a figure silhouetted by a light at a house two properties away when the killer was within a couple of feet of the house and directly below her. Her story and her version of events is not to be trusted. Lastly, we come to the car. McGinnis's report says that Duan saw the car speed away down the alley with the lights off. Again, it struck me as odd that he wouldn't have asked about the sound of the car, considering he had just conducted the sound test simulation less than 3 weeks prior. But after reading DeWan's testimony, I'm guessing McGinnis did ask him, and he just didn't like the answer. Unfortunately for McGinnis, prosecutor Art Cotter did ask DeWan about the sound of the car at trial. Unfortunately for Jody, their attorney didn't pounce on his answer. From the transcript, this is the prosecution questioning James. Quote, "Did you hear the car when it left?" "Yeah, I heard it." "What did it sound like?" "To me, it sounded like a little four-cylinder. Like, it sounded like a little Honda or, you know, a little small compact car. You know, from the acceleration, you know. I know about cars, you know. I took auto mechanics." Cotter, mm-hmm. James, "And I can tell that the engine, either the engine was messed up or the car was just a little small car." Cotter, "So the engine might have been messed up?" "Could have been." "Okay, thank you." End quote. Remember in Lenny Williams and Victoria Miles' testimony about the sound test, Cotter tried to validate their mechanical knowledge. Victoria said her son's father used to work on cars, and Lenny said he had a family member that worked on cars. But here, DeWan came right out with it. It sounded like a little four-cylinder car. Quote, "like a little Honda." And he knows that because he's worked on cars. He took auto mechanics. And I can tell you, as someone who knows a little bit about cars myself, there is a distinct difference between the sound of a little four-cylinder engine and the sound of a V8 motor, which is what Jody had in their car. Those two sounds are not even close. And you see the one thing that Cotter drew out of that statement. So the engine could have been messed up. He said that because Jody's car had a loud exhaust, a bad muffler. So Cotter's trying to somehow tie a little four-cylinder like a Honda into Victoria's statement about Jody's Cadillac. But that's not at all what DeWan is saying. First of all, if the car had a bad muffler, he would have said that. He knows cars, he knows mechanics, and a bad muffler is an obvious and distinct sound. Also, a bad muffler makes a car louder. And listen to what he's saying. He says it's either a little four-cylinder, or if it's not, it must be a car with a messed up engine, meaning it's not firing on all cylinders. A car with a large engine sounding like a car with a small engine would not be louder, like a car with a bad muffler. And to put a final pin on this, I want to circle back to Victoria's original description of the car. This is what she said on the night of the murder. Quote, "She said that she saw the car after she looked out of the south window of her apartment. She said that there is plastic over the windows of her apartment, so she didn't get a good look at the car. She described it as being small and box-shaped." End quote. Small and box-shaped, which sounds an awful lot like, quote, "To me, it sounded like a little four-cylinder, like it sounded like a little Honda or, you know, a little small compact car," end quote. Not a Cadillac with a V8 and a bad muffler. The last thing that I want to do today is to try to fill in the gap in time where DeWan wasn't paying attention to what Mario was doing. Remember, he saw Mario pull up, he saw someone walk into the house, he saw Mario open his trunk, and didn't see anything after that until the shots were being fired. To fill in that gap, we need to go to the witness statement of a woman named Chamika Jones, known then by her nickname, Coco. Jones talked to McGinnis and gave a statement in March, and we never hear from her again. She wasn't asked to testify at the trial. Coco lived directly across the street from the crime scene. She actually lived in the house that Angelique Bell lives in now. McGinnis had to track her down. He had been told by Terrence Hunter that he heard that she had some information about the murder. Terrence, as you'll remember from last week, was actually trying to snitch on Jody. In the letter to McGinnis, he says that, quote, "a Mr. Williams recently moved into his unit in the jail and told him that this woman named Coco saw Jody and three other people kill Mario." He also says that Mr. Williams is related to Mario. I did some checking today to confirm this, and I was able to do exactly that. Mr. Williams, that was in the tank with Terrence Hunter and Leon Newcomb, is in fact Andre Williams. You know, the guy who Canvas says they dropped off at the crime scene minutes before the murder, but he says he only saw Mario talking to him alone on the street a few blocks away that night. That Andre Williams. He's the one that told Terrence Hunter that Coco saw Jody at the crime scene. And McGinnis, of course, jumped at the opportunity to find a witness who could put Jody on the scene. Unfortunately for him, that is not what he got out of Chamika Jones. This is what she had to say from the report. Quote, I interviewed Jones on 3/20/02 at 11:20 a.m. at Benton Harbor Police Department. Jones used to live at 773 Broadway on 11/15/01 when DeMario Lowe's was murdered. Jones stated that she was acquainted with the victim, DeMario. She stated that she saw DeMario outside of 784 Broadway. She stated that he was driving a red car and that it was backed into the driveway and the trunk was raised and music was playing. Jones said that there were several other individuals around the car. She said it was approximately five or six other people. Jones stated that she heard them talking, but she could not make out what they were saying. She stated that she did not think it was arguing because the people didn't seem upset. Jones stated approximately 10 minutes later, she heard gunshots. Jones stated that there were a lot of shots, possibly 8 to 9. Jones was not able to tell whether there were multiple guns or a single gun. She stated that the gunshots sounded like they were very close to her building. Jones stated she got down when she heard the shots. She said she later got up and looked out the window. She said she saw something hanging out the front door of 784 Broadway, but she did not know what it was. Jones stated that she later found out it was an arm. She later saw the police and a crowd of people, and she was told that someone had got shot. End quote. So Chamika in no way identified Jody. But what she did say was invaluable to any real investigation. There wasn't a lone gunman who had an argument and killed DeMario. There were several people. Five or six people that were hanging around Mario's car right before the murder. Chamika fills in the gap when Duan wasn't watching. Duan saw Mario open his trunk, and he stopped paying attention after that. He was parked a few properties to the north of the crime scene. But Chamika was directly across the street. And while Duan wasn't watching, five or six people approached Mario while he had his trunk open, and they were talking to him. Neither Chamika or Duan were watching when the shooting started. Chamika was hiding on the ground during all the shooting, but Duan looked up to see the final few shots being fired from the person in the doorway, and he saw that shooter run away behind the house. Then they both looked at the one place where there was light, the doorway, and saw DeMario's arm hanging out of the door. I told you a few weeks ago that a witness had come forward over the summer. It was actually after the very first episode of the season aired. They don't want to be identified and they won't give the name of the shooter. But the story they told was that they were across the street and saw the murder happen. They said there was a group of men. They don't know how many, but there were several. The shooting started out by Mario's car and they chased him into the house. Two or three of the men chased Mario into the door. Then the first two ran out, and the last one out stopped in the doorway, turned and fired the final shots. They all scattered. Think about how that fits with what Duan and Chamika saw. The men approach Mario when Duan isn't looking. Chamika happens to look out and sees the group of men around the car and goes back about her business. Then the shots start and she and Duan both duck and cover. While neither of them are looking, the group chases Mario into the house. All but the final shooter run out of the house and scatter into the darkness. And as that person turns to take the final shots, just like the witness said, Duan looks up and sees him finish unloading his gun into the house and run away into the darkness. Remember, what Jody recalls hearing Victoria say on her 911 call when the dispatcher asks who was there. She said, "I don't know. There's a whole bunch of people down there." Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music for Season 15 is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. Doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell, and if you know my husband, Dax, then you also know he loves shopping for a car. Selling a car? Not so much.
We're really doing this, huh?
Thankfully, Carvana makes it easy. Answer a few questions, put in your VIN or license, and done. We sold ours in minutes this morning, and they'll come pick it up and pay us this afternoon.
Bye-bye, Truckee.
Of course, we kept the favorite.
Hello, other Truckee.
Sell your car with Carvana today. Terms and conditions apply.